Are resorbable stents a good idea?
Recommendations to prevent and treat substance abuse disorders.
A real mind control prosthesis.
And the cost effectiveness of total knee replacements.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on March 31st, 2017. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we should turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. I think this has been an ongoing issue and one that I've been quite interested in. Should we use stents that are bioresorbable, or should we leave those stents in place, and how does that work over the long haul?
Stents have been around to treat coronary artery disease or blockage in the arteries for over a decade, but they've been primarily metal stents. Those metal stents stay there, and they prevent the artery from having its normal function, that is contracting and relaxing. It can actually get in the way, too, if the person later needs to have bypass surgery. So that left the door open for having what are called bioabsorbable stents. They're made from compounds that can absorb over a period of time. Approximately a year and a half ago, I had the privilege of being on the FDA panel that approved the use of bioabsorbable stents here in the United States. And so the question is, how do they compare to the metallic stents? This study of 1,845 patients who were randomized to receive either a typical metallic stent versus one of these bioabsorbable stents. And the patients were followed for 2 years. The study was meant to go further, but there was some concern, and so the investigators actually revealed the results earlier. And when they looked at some of the major outcomes, there was no difference between the two stents over the course of 2 years. But what they did notice was there was about a 3.5-fold increased risk of a thrombosis or a clot forming in the blood vessels in which one of the bioabsorbable stents was placed. And that obviously increased the risk of having a heart attack.
And so probably if we extrapolated those results out further, there would be an even more pronounced rate of restenosis. That's just my guess. We certainly see that with other kinds of interventions that are used for this. And so I guess I would ask you to cut right to the chase. Based on these results, what would you recommend to patients who are going to get stents?
This seems to be a particular problem in the smaller diameter blood vessels. So for the smaller coronary arteries, I'd say that the bioabsorbable stent is less desirable. In the larger blood vessels, particularly when we combine it with other imaging techniques to make sure it's been implanted right, it's probably equivalent. But at this particular point, I wouldn't recommend them in the smaller blood vessels.
Speaking of not recommending, let's turn to the British Medical Journal. It is just unbelievable the number of people who are going out there and having total knee replacements. Lots of folks I've talked to about it say, wow, I waited so long, I should have done this way sooner. The primary indication usually is osteoarthritis of the knee, but in this study, they say, wait. Unless you have really severe osteoarthritis, this is probably not the right choice.
And as you mentioned, since 2000, the rates of total knee replacement in the United States have doubled. Now, it's not because people are having more osteoarthritis. It's because we're implanting them in people that are less symptomatic. Now, a total knee replacement does not improve your survival. It's intended to improve the quality of life. Does it, in fact, do that? And at what cost? We assess that with what's called a QALY, the Quality Adjusted Life Year. So they looked at 7,000 patients in two different studies that were at high risk for knee replacement. And about 8 to 9% of these patients actually underwent a knee replacement. And they asked, did that actually improve the quality of life? And if so, at what cost? And what they determined was, overall for the entire group, there was very minimal improvement in quality of life and at a tremendous cost of about $200,000 per quality of life adjusted year. Obviously, the quality of life was improved more in those that have more severe symptoms. And by the way, it was more cost effective. So it appears that we're probably offering total knee replacements to people that are minimally symptomatic and won't likely receive benefit from it at a very high cost.
And of course, I hearken back to studies we've discussed recently for management of pain and even improved function relative to people who have knee osteoarthritis that are significantly less intrusive.
Absolutely. And we've talked before, people refer to our previous podcast. It's important to note that even in patients that have total knee replacement, about a third of them have chronic pain that can be worse than the pain they started with if it's minimal to begin with.
Let's turn from here, since we're across the pond, to The Lancet. I served it up as the first truly mind-controlled prosthesis, a single case report.
very seldom do we report on a single patient report, but this really is groundbreaking. It starts with a gentleman that about 8 years ago had a bicycle accident that resulted in him being quadriplegic. Fast forward to investigators in Case Western and Cleveland Clinic that have been working to try to stimulate muscles. When you sever the spinal cord, the brain still works well. It's trying to command the muscles to do something. The muscles are still intact. It's just that that communication through the spinal cord is severed. So what these investigators did was they started by doing functional MRI, looking at which part of the brain commands movement of the arms and hand in this particular individual. They told him, think about moving your arm and hand, and we can identify which areas of the brain control that. And then they implanted electrodes, about 186 electrodes in the brain. And then they implanted electrodes in the muscles as well to stimulate the muscles. After implantation of the electrodes in the brain, they had him begin to think about moving his arm and hand again and transmitted that not to his arm and hand, but actually to a computer screen where he could see what he was doing to kind of train the brain and to identify which electrodes. And then they hooked him up to the arm and hand, by the way, which also had been stimulating the muscles because they had been atrophied to try to get them to have increased strength. So over the course of about 2 years, they put the two together, and now he's able to eat mashed potatoes, drink coffee. He's even able to scratch his nose with about a 90% accuracy.
It really is amazing. And of course, for people who are quadriplegic, the contemplation of life moving forward from such a traumatic injury is really depressing at best. So clearly offers hope, no doubt in my mind, that as we get better at this, it's going to reduce the amount of time it takes to do the training.
In fact, we need to miniaturize these things. And it's just one particular muscle group. It's just one limb. It's not all four limbs. What would be really interesting is if we could take the brain and have the thoughts and actually transmit it to the spinal cord. But in any case, this is very exciting news.
And that's the one I'm going to talk about on the blog this week. Finally, let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine. This time, we're taking a look at that sobering issue, our drug problem nationally.
And Elizabeth, we usually don't talk about health or public policy. We usually restrict our conversations to recent studies. But this is a huge issue because the number of opioid deaths in the United States has doubled. In fact, we now have more opioid deaths in the United States than we do motor vehicle accident deaths. In the past, this addiction has thought to be a character flaw. Someone just lacked self-control, and as a result, they became addicted. And the way we treat that is we would incarcerate the individual. But what's become more clear is this is actually a chronic disease in which there's a genetic component, but there's also some neural connections that happen in the form of addiction as well. So the American College of Physicians has come out with recommendations about how we need to prevent this and how we need to approach this in terms of treatment. The prevention we've talked before about, minimizing the use of opioids in the treatment of pain. When it does require opioids, they need to be prescribed time limited, and the physicians oftentimes should go on a national prescribing program to make sure that the person's not receiving opioids from other healthcare providers. And then finally, when it comes down to treatment, we need to treat it like a chronic disease. I think that the recommendations are very cogent and they're based upon evidence. And I think it's important for our listeners to be aware of them.
I'm going to add to that and remind you of something I mentioned to you before, that a colleague at Hopkins has put forward the notion that physicians need to be trained, not just very specifically trained in the prescription of these meds, but also in getting people off of them in a very prescribed transition to other modalities and less dramatic meds, if you will, so that they can step them down.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because there are specific training programs in there that teach primary care physicians how to use the proper medication to get people off of these addictions. That training is very important and very effective, by the way. The second is that there are medications now available to help prevent death associated with opioid use. That is naloxone. And there's a movement to make sure that individuals that are opioid addicted have access to it at all times. It ought to be available in all EMS and in many public places as well, because the treatment for this to prevent death is very effective.
I would just mention, of course, that the synthetic fentanyls that are largely originating in China that are making their way to this country, there's at least one of those that is not reversible by naloxone. so that the street drugs are also emerging as a huge issue with regard to this public health crisis.
Thanks for mentioning that, Elizabeth. That's really important, too. About 22.5 million people in the U.S. needed treatment for an illicit drug or alcohol use problem, but less than 20% received it.
Okay. That, then, is a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.